On a Monday, it's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Learning about alcohol concerns in our state prisons. At a state corrections department meeting earlier this year, the agency's top official raised questions about the amount of drinking and driving by prison workers and how often staff were coming to work intoxicated. Department leaders wanted to better understand how often these problems were happening and what could be done about them. WPR learned of the concerns recently for documents obtained under open records laws. You can join in. Are you a current or former corrections worker? What do you think people should know about the demands of your job? Are you recovering from alcoholism or another addiction? What types of resources do you think would help the corrections department address staff alcohol issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kevin Carr is secretary designee at the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Secretary Carr, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate. Good morning.
So back in February, you were trying to gauge the scope of alcohol-related problems among corrections workers. What have you learned since then?
Well, you know, at a warden's meeting back in February, I voiced my concern based on just the short time that I had been there in reviewing employee personnel matters, that there were a number of OWI arrests involving our correctional staff. And having been in law enforcement for 39 years, with 30 years of that at the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office, I was concerned about staff wellness and for our employees and what the number of OWI arrests seemed to suggest about the level of stress and the number of hours that our employees were working in our facilities.
So what numbers were you finding? How often are workers drinking and driving or coming to work intoxicated?
Well, you know, the numbers seemed to suggest that in 2017 and 2018, we averaged about 20 OWI arrest cases a year at DOC. And the year-to-date numbers right now are trending in the wrong direction. In 2017, year-to-date, we had 9, and in 18, we had 11, and now in 2019, we have 13 OWI cases year-to-date. And these cases stem from line officers up to command staff officers.
So how bad is this issue? Are people being routinely caught drinking on the job? Does that happen?
Not really.
Okay.
In fact, that was probably a misstatement. I'm not that much aware of that occurring on a routine basis, but it's more so after hours drinking and driving. You know, our staff have some of the most stressful jobs and work in difficult situations. They experience trauma regularly, which can be difficult to deal with and process. You know, and they're also tasked with working a lot of long hours and overtime. But we're working to fix that problem by the development of a new recruitment and retention program that we hope will help us fill some of our many vacancies.
We're talking with Department of Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr discussing how his agency is addressing staff alcohol issues, OWI issues. What questions do you have for the secretary? Are you a corrections worker or a concerned citizen? What do you think the secretary should hear? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Secretary Carr, WPR, we've reported extensively this year on Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. We love beer, celebrate life with it, but also really shining a light on the deadly problems like drunk driving. Do you worry about there being a culture of tolerance with alcohol in your department?
Well, I don't necessarily view it that way. I just view it as potential problem that we should certainly recognize and help our employees as much as we can because we really believe in employee wellness. DOC has many resources in place to help staff through trauma and to support them in their professional and personal lives through our employee assistant program. We also have a program that we use called Peer Supporters, which started back in the 1990s but has continued to grow since then. And the program has been utilized numerous times depending on what's going on in a person's personal or professional life.
The dangers of drinking and driving are well known. What are your main concerns with staff being intoxicated on the job? What can go wrong?
Well, of course, as I said earlier, I don't view that as the major issue here. I'm not aware of that many instances of people actually being intoxicated at work. But obviously, if that did happen, their judgment is impaired, their ability to perform their duties is compromised. There's a number of issues where that is just obviously not a desirable situation.
How are corrections staff officers disciplined for this type of misconduct? You can see it in their history, in their file, but at what point do you have to let your employees go, actually fire them?
Well, you know, the current disciplinary system is pretty much governed by state law and administrative rule. And here at the state of Wisconsin, they employ a concept which is, you know, commonly applied around the country and public employees called progressive discipline. And you have to stay within the confines of the progressive discipline matrix in order to ultimately relieve somebody of their employment. At the state currently, you can give a person a letter of expectation, then a one-day suspension, a three-day suspension, then a five-day suspension, you know, for what would be a third or fourth offense. And then that person could be removed from employment. If a person engages in some conduct that is extremely egregious, you know, of course, you can skip those progressive steps and go to relieving a person of their employment. But all of those things that I just said about progressive discipline and suspensions is secondary to the overall desire to help our employees work through their issues and maintain their employment and their careers. That is our primary objective.
You mentioned concerns about stress. What have you learned about what's causing this, the cause of workers drinking?
Well, you know, what I'm hearing from line officers in the emails and phone calls that I get from them every week is, you know, working the long hours, working in an environment in prison where, you know, you are always on guard and watching your safety and the safety of your fellow officers, you know, from the moment that you walk in the door until the time you walk out at night, and then sometimes worrying about encountering subjects that you may have supervised in custody in your community. Those are all factors that cause a lot of stress and concern for our officers. And you know, in addition to the fact that they're working, you know, several 16-hour shifts a week, not being compensated fairly.
There's a whole list of issues. We're learning about alcohol issues in Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. Agency's top official, Kevin Carr, is with us to talk about how his agency is addressing staff coming to work under the influence. What questions are on your mind? Have you seen alcohol issues in your own workplace? We're at 800-642-1234. The State Capitol Report continues in just a minute on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you have a line to Corrections Secretary-designee Kevin Carr as we talk about his agency's response to concerns over alcohol use by prison workers. WPR learned of the concerns recently from documents obtained under open records laws. What is on your mind about this? Are you recovering from alcoholism or other addictions? What types of resources do you think are helpful? And how much leeway should the corrections department allow workers? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Secretary Carr stays with us for this conversation. Let's go to the phones now with Paul joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind about this?
I was a correctional officer, and then I became a probation parole agent, and I worked in Milwaukee, and it was a very stressful environment. I ended up drinking to cover up all that stress, and there was other stressors in my life, and I ended up getting a drunk driving. I left the department because of it. I probably could have fought it through the union and kept my job, but I was so stressed out, and I didn't feel supported by management at the time. I felt like they weren't there to help me get through these issues. They were there to do their job, investigate it, and punish me for my behavior. And of course, everybody looks at the behavior of alcohol-related issues, but nobody looks at it's hard to look at the underlying issue and separate the behavior from the issues that are causing the behavior.
Paul, thank you for the call. Secretary, Paul didn't feel supported. How does the agency monitor for stress or burnout?
Well, you know, our staff are our greatest asset. And, you know, our staff's dedicated to helping those in our care and protect our communities. And we can't stress how grateful we are to have them and want to be sure that we support them in any way that we can. And under Governor Evers' leadership, there's a reclaimed effort to lift up state employees to show them how much we appreciate them and acknowledge how much they do for their communities. With that being said, you know, we have several programs, like I said, the peer supporters, the employee assistance program, and we ask our frontline supervisors to, you know, who have daily contact with our line staff to, you know, work with them and observe, you know, their employees in order to determine, you know, if there's any changes in behavior. Is there, you know, are they starting to call in sick a lot? Are they starting to be tardy a lot? Are they having job performance issues that might indicate that there's some other issue that's driving those changes in work behavior?
Let's take another call now. Brad is joining us from Columbus. Hi, Brad.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm happy to hear the comments from our new corrections leader that they're going forward with taking care of our employees. And to me, the whole problem is our legislative decisions in the past of, first of all, making too many laws and incarcerating people too long and not backing it up with the staff to handle that. And in addition to taking care of the staff, finding ways to help the prisoners. I mean, there's, you know, that's basically it.
Brad, thanks for the call. What is being done along those lines of recidivism? And could that be impacting the corrections officers in terms of, you know, having to work overtime just to keep up with the demands of the job?
Well, currently, if I understand Brad's question correctly, it's more about providing services to the inmates than it is for, or the people that we care for in our institutions, as it is for our employees. But what I can tell you is that currently we have over 700 vacancies here at the Department of Corrections, and we're working to try to fill those vacancies by the creation of a new recruitment and retention plan that I mentioned earlier. Now, those vacancies drive overtime use, and when employees work a lot of overtime, they are under additional stress and physical toil, and those things can lead to the stressors that cause people to engage in behaviors that are not exactly in their best interest, like excessive alcohol use. And that's why We provide peer supports that can, you know, peer supporters who are working. These are coworkers that are working alongside these individuals who can walk up to an individual and say, hey, Joe or Susie, you know, I've noticed that, you know, you've been behaving a little bit differently. You know, what's going on? Is there something that I can help you with? And those are the types of resources and observations that need to be made in order for us to be in the position to provide assistance to our people as needed.
So, you have hundreds of vacancies. What is this new recruitment and retention plan? Can you tell us more about what you're changing in that area?
Well, we are still in development. We are ready to roll this thing out probably in the next month or two, but we're going to be using a different strategy as far as communicating with the public as to what a great career corrections can be and how, you know, what the benefits are of serving your community and working for the state of Wisconsin. There's a lot of positive aspects to working in corrections that people don't know about. Hopefully, under the governor's leadership, the pay structure is going to get better as we move on, and it's going to be a very desirable job for people in the future. So, I hope to tell you more about that plan once it's finalized.
We're talking with Department of Corrections Secretary Kevin Carr. He's with us to discuss staffing issues and the state budget. What questions or comments do you want to share with the secretary? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Secretary, the state legislature is considering a 14% raise for corrections workers as part of this year's state budget. Would that be enough to address pay concerns?
One of the first things that I did in January when I was appointed to this position was ask for a staffing pay study to compare the starting rate of correctional officers in our surrounding states with what our current correctional officers were getting. Our current correctional officers are making about $16.62, I think, an hour. And in the surrounding states, the average is between $21 and $22 an hour. Now, the raise that's being proposed in the budget, should the governor approve the budget, and I have no idea what the governor is going to do at this point, is a step in the right direction. We did not get in the situation that we're in with such a wide pay gap overnight, and we're not going to get out of it overnight. If I had a magic wand and bags of money laying around, I would get every single one of our employees, not only correctional, but nursing, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, everybody that works in DLC up to the same wage that they deserve based on a comparable position in the private sector. But it's fiscally not possible. So we have to do it incrementally. So we are taking steps in the right direction, depending on what happens with the budget. And
is there anything in the budget that you are urging Governor Evers to veto?
Well, those discussions have taken place, but I'm not at liberty to disclose what those discussions have been.
And with our limited time left, can you give us an update on the status of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the state's juvenile prisons in northern Wisconsin? What is the best solution for these facilities, and how does the state ultimately get there?
Well, the best solution, I think, is to ultimately build the new Type 1 facilities in Milwaukee and Hortonia, as the governor has suggested. And I can certainly tell you that, under the court order monitor, there will be a monitor's report coming out soon that I hope is going to suggest that we are making significant progress up at Lincoln Hills insofar as the environment and the requirements of the consent decree that the Department of Corrections is under regarding the operation at Lincoln Hills. So we're making progress, and we're not making as much progress as we all would like. We would all love that every single aspect of the consent decree was totally compliant, and that we were, you know, that there was absolutely no issues. But as I've found since I've been here at DOC, there are issues everywhere, and we're constantly engaged in process and operational improvement every day to try to get better.
Secretary Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
Kevin Carr is Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. And the State Capitol Report continues with the discussion around step therapy. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about legislation on the governor's desk that would target a treatment process called step therapy. It's where insurers have you try a less expensive drug that has proven effective for most people with your condition before you can move up a step to a more expensive drug or therapy. And that legislation that passed the Assembly and Senate would allow doctors to better tailor treatment to an individual's situation. Are you a patient who has been affected by step therapy? How did that affect the treatment you received? How many medications or treatments did you have to try before you got what you needed? We're at 800-642-1234, and you can join in. Angie Tease is the State Government Relations Manager for the National Psoriasis Foundation and leader of the Wisconsin Step Therapy Coalition. That's a statewide organization representing people with chronic diseases and healthcare providers. Angie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
So last month, we saw the legislature pass bills to streamline the process of step therapy. Can you walk us through exactly what that legislation would do?
I am happy to do so. First, I like to start with an example of a patient, because I think that really impacts or, you know, gives the listeners kind of an idea of how the legislation would benefit her. So we worked with volunteers from across the state, and one in particular stands out. She's from New Lisbon, and she went to her doctor for psoriasis, and her doctor prescribed her a medication, and in working with the insurance company, they required her to go through a series of three medications before they would ultimately cover the medication that her doctor had originally prescribed. The process of stepping through those three medications took approximately 4 years. And in one case, they wanted her to travel three times a week, or it was 3 hours round trip, four times a week from New Lisbon down to La Crosse, where her dermatologist was at. And another treatment required her husband applying topical ointment throughout, you know, the majority of her skin and kind of wrapping her in saran wrap. So really difficult. She's a young mom of two kids and trying to work full time. This had a significant impact on her life. What this legislation would do, it would prioritize that relationship between the doctor and the patient. In this case, the doctor knew that the medication that he originally prescribed would work best for this person. And through this legislation, there are four kind of expedited processes. We call them exceptions, where that doctor could have applied for one of those exceptions to get an answer quickly and get her on that medication.
So explain,
in a more timely fashion.
Yeah, what are these four exceptions? What does this bill do?
Sure. So this bill says, we call them common sense guidelines, patient protections. So if you are stable on a medication and your insurance changes, you know, you change jobs, or maybe your insurance provider changes within work, you are able to stay on that medication. You don't have to go back and step through the process to get on that medication again, which was happening with some of our volunteers. The other is that if that medication that the insurance company wants you to try is contraindicated, meaning it's expected to have an adverse reaction or cause a significant psychiatric harm or, again, an adverse reaction, then you don't have to take that medication either. The third is that if you've previously tried and failed the medication that the insurer wants you to try, you don't have to do that. Again, just kind of common sense. And then I'm pulling up my fourth. But essentially, they're really just...
And there's a waiting period, 24 hours, you know, and if the insurer doesn't come through in that 24-hour window, that the doctor can go ahead with that medication? Is that one of them?
Well, so what was happening is that the doctor and the patient were working together and trying to get the individual covered, and you know, currently. And they would apply for an exemption under current protocol and try to work with the existing parameters. And sometimes patients were waiting up to 2 weeks, maybe a month, for an answer from their insurance company on whether that medication would be covered or not. So what this legislation does is it says, hey, that's a little bit too long. Patients need some certainty. Providers need some certainty. And so it says, it provides a window of 3 business days in non-emergency situations and up until the end of the next business day for emergency situations. If an insurer does not respond within those time points, then that individual can get that medication and it's assumed covered.
We're talking with Angie Tees, the State Government Relations Manager for the National Psoriasis Foundation and a leader of the Wisconsin Step Therapy Coalition, a statewide organization representing people with chronic diseases and healthcare providers. How would this new legislation change the treatment you receive? What kind of difference would that make in your life? And physicians, if Governor Evers signs this bill into law, how will that affect the way you're able to help your patients? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Angie, when do insurers decide to deploy this practice of step therapy?
It's really up to an insurance company, kind of what their internal protocols are. A good piece of this legislation is that it doesn't ban or prohibit the practice of step therapy. It simply says that for individuals like ours in the psoriatic community and others like in the arthritis community and the multiple sclerosis community, we have really complex and progressive and kind of quirky diseases, very highly individualized, that we need to be able to kind of access those exceptions processes. Others, you know, in the chronic space do as well. Oftentimes our communities will have be on multiple medications due to comorbidities associated with our conditions. And so the doctor really is in the best place to make that determination. That's not to say that step therapy protocols don't have a place, but what this legislation would also do is it establishes, so when an insurer is developing step therapy guidelines or protocols, they do so, they kind of cherry pick or have access to, you know, kind of the information that they choose. And it's really unclear how some of those processes are developed right now. And so this legislation says, hey, we'd like that to be transparent. We'd like the step therapy protocols to be evidence-based, based on peer-reviewed science. And if a provider or a patient says, you know, how is this developed, that they can point to the systematic way that it was developed, again, on peer-reviewed evidence-based data.
Angie, we've been talking about, you know, psoriasis in particular. Are there a number of different treatment options for psoriasis, a number of different prescription drugs on the market that could be tried?
Well, the beautiful and kind of quirky thing about psoriasis is that we know that there are probably seven or eight medications that are kind of have a seal, and we go to as far as recommended treatment options. But again, it goes back to, Humira may work for one individual, Enbrel for another, some work Otezla or Remicade. It really is going to depend on whether or not that doctor and that patient kind of what their indicators are. Again, pointing to the need to really elevate that provider and patient relationship and have that provider be the determining factor on the medication that the individual tries.
Well, let's take a call. Let's go to Jordan in Madison. Hi, Jordan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, just segueing on the conversation about what medication today. Psoriasis for me, and I've had it for a number of years, it's really unpredictable. On the outside, of course, one could see the skin, what impact it has on the skin. And when there'll be flare-ups, and that's random. And you know, who knows what's going to cause the flare-up. And then in the inside of your body, there could be a type of arthritis called psoriatic arthritis, which I do not have. But that can have a big impact, and that happens random. It comes and goes. So you're dealing with a disease that's just random. This disease impacts everybody's life, part of their life, whether it be business or personal life. And what this legislation does for me, now I haven't gone, luckily for me, I didn't go through step therapy, at least not as yet. Probably because I've had it so long, I've gone through all the steps. But, you know, at the very least, no matter what doctor I choose or what insurance company I have, I'm going to have a process that's predictable for me, and that I can be assured that that's what that insurance company is going to have to deal with, instead of each insurance company dictating to me what their protocol is.
Jordan, thanks. Yeah, thank you for the call. Angie, would this bill help streamline and make the process of getting a prescription more predictable?
It absolutely should. And we know that physicians spend a lot of time on bureaucracy and completing forms and such, and that it can lead to burnout and turnover and such. And so that was a key indicator on this, and something Senator Darling felt very strongly about. And so that is the intention, or a intention, of the legislation in addition.
More than a dozen states have laws overriding step therapy, where a patient must try certain drugs first, even if their doctor disagrees. We're looking at legislation that would create exceptions to Wisconsin's step therapy protocol. Angie Tees is with the National Psoriasis Foundation, and she leads the Wisconsin Step Therapy Coalition. Your stories, your questions, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. Have you been impacted by step therapy? What happened? Or maybe you think the step therapy process is important to make sure that physicians aren't prescribing the most expensive drugs before considering alternatives. Join in the conversation. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about bipartisan legislation on step therapy. The bill in the governor's desk would require pre-authorization for expensive drugs, but there would be exemptions, and the insurer would have 24 hours to respond to emergency medication requests. If there's no response during that time, the doctor's request would automatically be approved. Don Dial of Kenosha has rheumatoid arthritis. He says initially he couldn't get the medication his physician recommended.
I'm 58 years old. The crippling effects of this step therapy decision left me feeling like I was 90.
Have you been affected by the step therapy process? What changed about your treatment process? Maybe you think the step therapy is important to make sure that physicians aren't prescribing the most expensive drugs. We're at 800-642-1234. Angie Tees heads up the Wisconsin Step Therapy Coalition. She stays with us. And let's bring in Dr. Lisa Dodson now. She is Dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin's Central Wisconsin Campus. She's also president of the Wisconsin Academy of Family Physicians. Dr. Dodson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So how has the step therapy process affected the physicians you work with at the Academy, Wisconsin Academy of Family Physicians, and the treatment that they're able to offer their patients?
Well, it causes a great deal of frustration, and it can cause a lot of delays, both of which are harmful to both the patient, to the physician, to their staff, and overall to public health.
In what ways? I mean, can you be a little more specific on how that disrupts the patient-physician relationship?
Well, can you imagine sitting with a patient saying, you know, here's the drug that I recommend for you because I have good reason to believe that it will be the most effective. However, because of insurance company regulations, I'm going to back up two steps to a different drug, prove to them it doesn't work, and then we're going to go on to another one, and eventually we'll get to the one that I think actually will be best for you. That's a pretty damaging relationship problem between the physician and the patient, not to mention harmful to the patient in many ways.
So I understand UW Health recently said it had 50 employees whose only job was to pre-authorize medications and challenge denials by insurers. Is this pretty customary at hospitals from what you've seen?
Yeah, I think that that's been an ongoing problem, and it's not new. Certainly, this goes back as far as the 90s to sort of the first managed care era when denials started becoming a problem. When you think about 50 different people in one health system who all they do is deal with denials of care, that's pretty cost ineffective. And you think what we could divert that money to be taking care of patients rather than denying them care, it probably is something that is even wider spread than just the step therapy problem, but it certainly is rampant in that area.
Let's take another call now. Kelsey joining us from Madison. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. I'm also a new mom. I have an appointment with my doctor, my second appointment, and he did mention step therapy, though he didn't phrase it like that. He said that there would be a song and dance with the insurance company. The first medication they recommend is contraindicated for breastfeeding, and so he mentioned a little too casually for my liking that I would just have to stop breastfeeding. And I'm wondering, under this legislation, would that be one of the exemptions considered breastfeeding moms and medications that are contraindicated for breastfeeding or pregnancy?
Thanks for that question, Kelsey. Dr. Dodson?
Yes, that is one of the exact types of situations. We feel that patients should not have to completely disrupt their life. When you look at the advantages of breastfeeding, if there's a medication that can promote that and continue to allow you to breastfeed, that should be a top consideration.
Let's go to Mark now in Black River Falls. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just had a quick question for my own benefit and also maybe help someone else in the future. I was given a pain cure through the VA, and I developed what was called drug-induced aseptic meningitis. It was a drug allergy to it. And the reason I'm asking this or bringing this forward is, are there ways of testing patients prior to them be giving medications?
Mark, thanks for that call. Dr. Dodson, what about allergies and what is being prescribed here?
That's an excellent question. Unfortunately, for most drugs, we don't yet have the kind of personalized medicine that will allow us to predict to that degree of specificity that someone will react badly to a drug. There are certainly, in many cases, are indications that with a good thorough history, we can determine that a drug is more likely to have adverse effects. With the coming of personalized medicine at MCW, we're working on a lot of these issues. It will literally be possible in the future to maybe predict what Mark had happened to him and avoid that entirely, and with great cost savings as well as misery for patients and certainly risk to life and health. Right now, it's probably not that specific, but a good thorough history will often pull out different elements that might predict that a certain drug is going to be better than another.
Angie Tease, what types of insurance will this legislation apply to? Is it all insurance or just private?
That's a great question. It will, as of January 1st, 2020, assuming that Governor Evers signs it in coming weeks, which we expect him to do and are hopeful that he does so, this legislation will apply to private insurance. products that are regulated by the state. There is federal legislation pending in Congress that would regulate and provide these same protections to ERISA or large employer plans that are regulated by Congress.
Let's take another call now. Mary joins us from Middleton. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call. Okay. I am an MS patient. I am turning 55 this year. I was diagnosed 20-something years ago. And I went through this process basically because I needed to. I started with the first injectable. I tried all the injectables. I failed all of them. And then I tried an infusion for a while where the cost was so astronomical with my insurance at that time, I couldn't afford it. And then I started on one of the first medications that came out in pill form. And I've been taking this pill for 8 years, and it's amazing. It has helped so much. And I'm on my feet still, and I'm almost, you know, I'm almost 55 years old, and I'm very impressed. But my concern is with this STEP project, with someone like me who's already gone through all these steps with medication, will they require me to do this again?
Mary, thanks for the call. Dr. Dodson, what would happen in this situation?
Well, Mary's situation is one that actually is that this bill is trying to address. The need to go back to the beginning and start on the various steps all the way back, and there are many, particularly for disease like MS, this bill should allow her doctor to actually request and receive that permission to prescribe that drug on an ongoing basis right from the get-go within 24 hours. We certainly have seen in the past where over half of patients whose drugs were denied were on nothing within 30 days because of the back and forth problems. So not only is step therapy designed to help specifically Mary so that we don't have to go back to the beginning, but also to really expedite the process when there does need to be a new approval to a very short period of time so that patients are not off of their medications for any length of time.
Angie, as we start to wrap up here, are there things that this bill does not address that aren't fully wrapped up in how we approach step therapy? Are there still pitfalls?
Honestly, this legislation is a really good start. I think as, you know, and again, hopeful and that Governor Evers will sign the legislation and we will see it implemented beginning in January, but our intent is that all patients would be covered under step therapy. And so, again, looking at kind of the public insurance market and then additionally those insurance plans that are regulated by Congress. But honestly, this is a really good piece of legislation, and I think it points to the process by which we arrived here. It is a strong bipartisan piece of legislation. Unanimous voice votes in both the House and the Senate, and I will point to the leadership of Representative Nygren and Senator Darling and Senator Tustin and the Health Committee and Representative Sanfilippo on the Assembly side.
And we have to stop there. Angie, thank you. Together. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Angie Tease is State Government Relations Manager for the National Psoriasis Foundation. And Dr. Dodson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Lisa Dodson is Dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin Central Wisconsin Campus. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.